Welcome to Boundless. I'm Kathy Eldon. In these delicious conversations, we meet artists, activists, founders, and visionaries of all kinds who show us what becomes possible when we refuse to be defined by fear, loss, or limitation. This is a space for anyone ready to reclaim their creativity, trust their spark, and help shape a better future. Welcome to Boundless, where we explore how human beings navigate life's twists, turns, heartbreaks, breakthroughs, and occasional cosmic practical jokes, and somehow emerge wiser, kinder, and more creative on the other side. Today, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by filmmaker, storyteller, adventurer, and seeker Rocco Bellick, a dear friend of mine. Rocco has spent much of his life traveling the world in search of what truly makes people happy, a journey that has become his acclaimed documentary called Happy. Along the way, he's immersed himself in cultures, communities, and extraordinary human stories, one of them pretty heartbreaking, that reveal both our differences and our shared humanity. What I love most about Rocco is his curiosity. He doesn't just observe life, he dives in. Whether exploring remote corners of the world or the inner landscapes of the human spirit, he reminds us that meaning is often found where we least expect it. So let's journey together with a man with a truly boundless spirit, whose life has been devoted to asking some of the toughest questions we can ask. What makes a good life? What connects us? And how can we live more joyfully, more fully, and more boundlessly, I guess. Stay tuned.
Rocco, you've been here for me since you were 19 years old, I think. I've known you more than half of your life.
Yes.
I want to say how absolutely delighted I am to have you on our Boundless podcast. I think your life has been boundless in ways that we're going to understand a little bit more by the end of this conversation. You've had a very unusual life in many ways. And I'm intrigued to know in that those early years of yours, how what happened in the early years might have shaped what happened later on. So can you take me back in time?
Sure. So I was born in America, but my mom is Czech and my dad is Yugoslav. And I was growing up in Chicago, which is a pretty conservative place. Grown-ups looked normal. They did normal jobs. They didn't really like their jobs. Kids all had a lot of fun. We were rambunctious and sometimes broke rules. But it felt to me like growing up was not a wonderful path. Grown-ups would say to us, parents would say to us, hey, you guys have fun now. And you think you can screw around now, but just wait till you get older. You're going to have responsibilities. So you better start taking life seriously. And I remember just that didn't seem like a great outlook. And that combined with the fact that my parents were foreign. So our house always kind of smelled like funny food. And, you know, my mom didn't speak English when I was born. So my first language was Serbo-Croatian. So when I got to school, I didn't speak English. And I didn't understand what people were saying, but I didn't realize it was another language. I just thought it was some complicated words I didn't understand. So that was a bit of a learning curve. That was hard. And my teacher, I remember my kindergarten teacher was very unsympathetic. At least that's my memory of it. And so I always felt a bit like an outsider, even though I'm American, as American gets. We would spend summers instead of going to summer camp, like most of my friends, every other year or so, we would go to Yugoslavia to see my dad's family. Czechoslovakia was kind of off limits because it was behind the Iron Curtain when I was a kid. But we went to Eastern Europe and saw how this other culture existed. You know, we saw this other world that I think was very different than the experience of most of my friends in Chicago, who really just had this American perspective. And so I always felt like an outsider for those few reasons. Combining that with the fact that my mom loved history and education and politics and culture, she was insistent when she realized what we were learning at school, and more importantly, what we weren't learning at school, she thought our educational system was just absolutely deficient in terms of teaching us about the world. She wanted to supplement that, which she did every single day with stories about growing up under communism, especially. and stories of just other cultures. She was extremely well read. She is extremely well read. She's still with us. And so she insisted that I watch a lot of documentaries on TV, which I did.
Didn't she
And
break the TV, Rocco? Isn't there
what happened
a
is actually,
story?
this is in the 70s where TVs had this knob that would, click, click. And the knob had fallen off one day. And as we were figuring out, my mom with a wrench, figuring out how to turn the channel, there's a little metal spindle, and it was really hard with some vice grips to turn the channel. She just put it on PBS and left it there. And I was too, I literally couldn't. I mean, I spent an hour trying to change the damn channel. I wanted to watch cartoons. And she left it on channel 11, which interestingly in Chicago, it's WTTW, which stands for Window to the World. And it's exactly what it gave me. And that was my first experience with Africa, for example. That was my first experience with Kenya, with animals, with culture, with tribes that lived in different ways than I did. And it was all absolutely fascinating. I mean, it felt like half the documentaries were about World War II and the other half were about animals in Africa, or cultures.
You had another experience with Africa, which I know a little bit about, because you traveled to Kenya in order to go on a mad safari with some pretty amazing people. Can you tell me a little bit about that and how it might have impacted your future?
Well, exactly. So the sort of the priming had been done. I was interested in the world. I was going off to college. I had just gone off to college in Santa Barbara from Chicago. So California already was kind of fun and interesting. And my friend Jeff Gettleman and I were trying to figure out a way to get to Africa the next summer, the summer after freshman year. And Jeff is a really smart guy. He ended up becoming a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times, which he still is. Very smart guy. So we left it up to him to write the applications that would allow us to join organizations, nonprofit organizations that were, let's say, building a school or a hospital or a church in Africa. There are these programs that happen you can volunteer for. And somehow, even though I think he was writing these applications really well, and we were two, 18-year-old kids ready to work for free, we got rejected from everyone.
Oh my
But a
God.
friend of ours, Chris Nolan, who went on to be the Chris Nolan
Yeah,
movie
Chris Nolan.
mega, yes, he said, "Well, I have this friend at school, and he's got a friend in Kenya, and that friend in Kenya is doing this relief mission in Africa this summer. Maybe we could somehow join that." And so we got this guy's number, and I figured anybody leading a relief mission to Africa must be 50 or 60 years old and very serious and very busy. And I called the number, and I had clearly gotten the wrong number because there was this party going. I mean, I called, it was literally like a Sunday afternoon at 2 in the afternoon, and there was music, dance music blasting in the background. And some woman answered the phone. She said, "Oh, Dan Alden, does anybody know where Dan is?" And she goes, "Are you downstairs with the beer?" And it was very confusing. I thought I was calling a relief organization. And in fact, the man who was running it was a 19-year-old college kid, not that different than me, except that he was your biological son, and he had lived his own extraordinary upbringing. And he was leading this mission, which comprised 14 kids, the oldest of which was 18, that was Hayden, to raise money first and then deliver that money to refugees of a civil war in Mozambique. Now, I knew I wanted to go to Africa. I was ready to, hammer walls and paint things. I didn't realize how exciting it could be. And Dan, fortunately, he has some kind of a motto which says something like, "Keep your best people close, but always leave room for newcomers. Give people a chance." And he gave me a chance, and Jeff and Chris, and it was absolutely a life-changing experience. Where, most importantly, I realized that even though I was 18 and I was still feeling like a kid, mostly, I wasn't feeling empowered as an adult. I realized that it didn't matter. I had all the power I needed if I just chose to embrace it and act on the things that were meaningful to me, because I saw this kid, Dan, who was living like an adult, like the best version of an adult I'd ever seen, because he was taking life seriously. He was doing things that were meaningful, and he was having so much fun. He was having more fun than most kids. So that was a life-changing experience to realize we could impact people's lives in a positive way. We could have a great adventure doing it, and we could learn, and we could learn and be creative, and adulthood didn't have to be boring and something that I would have to grit my teeth and endure. It could be something extremely exciting and moving.
I'm very moved by what you're saying because many of our viewers know that Dan went on to become a photojournalist and he and Jeff Gettleman told stories that were really important in the world. Dan, while telling a story, was beaten and stoned to death together with three other young journalists. And he died to tell a story and he died following his mission in life. You have quite a lot of experience with that because your dad did the same thing in his own way. Can you talk a little bit about what drove him to follow something that led to his death?
Sure, I'll give a little background to
Background.
this. There was during World War II, it was a really tough time all over the world, but especially in Eastern Europe, or I should say in Eastern Europe. The story starts where there was a kid who did not have a mother. He was extremely poor. He's literally born in 1939, so he's living his first years in the middle of World War II. And the only place he could feel happy and peaceful was in the ocean, whether he was swimming or rowing or playing with his friends. And so he wanted to be a boat captain. He wanted to
I didn't know
escape.
that.
He wanted to get out and just experience life in that way that felt free and inspiring to him. And he did well in school, and instead of that, he became a doctor and he came to America. His dad said to him, "Look, if you really want to get the hell out of here, study medicine, because then you'll be able to go anywhere in the world and you'll have options. Even if you change your mind, you want to be a boat captain one day, every boat needs a medic, so you'll always be able to go in that direction. But if you become a merchant marine first, you'll never be able to change directions and become a doctor." So he did that for 40 or 50 years, I guess 40 years, and raised a family. And as he was facing retirement, this dream of being in the ocean came back. And I think he had lived his whole life feeling like he had done service. He had done things that were extremely meaningful. Being a doctor, he was a cardiologist. It's literally saving people's lives and also watching people perish. People who on their deathbeds had their own regrets about the things they did or didn't do. And often those regrets were about the things they didn't do, the dreams they had hoped but never pursued, and so they couldn't achieve. So when this dream to be in the ocean came back to him, he decided to have a rowboat built. The most pure way of experiencing the ocean to him in his late 50s was to row across the Atlantic Ocean. And at this point, he had a wife and he had two teenage daughters, and they begged him. They begged him not to go. They first thought he was joking. When they realized he was serious, I mean, one daughter was 12, one was 15. They were in extremely vulnerable positions in their life. They needed their dad, and no way is he allowed to go. And so for a few years, he didn't go, but eventually he said, "Look, if I don't do it now, I'll be too old. I won't be able to." And so he set off from Cape Cod and for 4 months at sea, rowing by himself. He had no sail, no motor, no backup, anything. Nobody really knew he was going. There's a few people in the family who knew. But he didn't want sponsorship. He wanted to kind of, I think, do the opposite thing. He had done his whole life. He was engaging the world in a way that was meaningful. And now I think he wanted to do something that was really meaningful to him that really nobody else could understand. I mean, I think he wanted to float under the cosmos and just feel what that feels like. And he wanted to be completely under his own control. So for 4 months, when he would call home to his wife, he would describe this magical experience he was having. He said in the middle of the night, sometimes the ocean was so calm, it felt like he was floating in space because the Milky Way was reflected like a mirror on the ocean. He couldn't tell where the horizon was. And she literally thought he had food poisoning. She said, "You don't sound like you've ever sounded. You sound crazy. You sound high. What's going on?" And he said, "I'm happier than I've ever been in my life." And so when he was just a few days from reaching land in Ireland, a huge storm hit, and the Coast Guard received an emergency signal from his boat. And a month later, they found his boat empty and capsized, and he was gone. And Yes, the man in the boat was my dad. I was 30 years old at the time. I had already been to Africa with Dan twice. I had traveled around the world with a backpack. I bought a horse in Tibet and rode it for a couple weeks through Tibet. I canoed down the Mississippi River. I had done all these adventures, and I knew for sure he was going to come home. When everybody was freaking out, my only experience with tragedy was with Dan, and I thought, okay, well, that was a fluke. It's not because of anything Dan did. It's not. It was just happened to be the wrong place at the wrong time. My dad was a very, very careful person. He wasn't crazy. He hadn't had a life of adventure like we had. He was extremely meticulous and prepared. So I figured he had a really, really good chance of doing this. And so when he disappeared, I just didn't even know how to talk to my stepmom and sisters about it because I had been supporting him the whole way. So your question, I think, was what drove him. And that's a tough one. I don't know, but I know the feeling of needing to do something. So, I just talked with a producer yesterday who's a commercial documentary producer, and their company produces tons of stuff. And she didn't sound like she really liked the stuff they were producing. She said, maybe 30% of the stuff we produce is more independent. And that's what I really love. And I feel very fortunate that the films I've been able to make are the ones I really want to make. And I do think of Dan, and I do think of my dad, and I think of so many other people who haven't made it to the age that I am. I think one day I'm gone. I don't know when that's coming, so I better spend today in a way that makes sense if it's finite. So I believe that, I've never had a dream that I've held inside that I've repressed, whereas my dad did. In a way, I feel like very different than my dad in those ways, because because of the sacrifices he and my mom made to come here and to build a life in America in a free country, give us the opportunities. I was able to just take those opportunities he didn't have when he was growing up in World War II and Yugoslavia. So, but I understand that had I repressed that this long, because he was 50 when he came up with the idea to row, he'd always wanted to be in the ocean, but he never really quite knew how he was going to do it. I'm 54. If I waited this long till I finally pursued a dream, it would be like an explosion waiting to happen. I don't know how I would even contain it that long. So, and I have had glimpses, even with Dan and in Africa, one of the most memorable aspects of that trip was just being free. Even though it was 14 of us, I mean, there was no grown-ups around, or we didn't feel like it, and we were sleeping under the stars, and we didn't know if the next day on the road we would meet rebels or we would meet government soldiers, and whether they would be drunk or angry or happy or. And it was a genuine exploration and a feeling of how to be alive. Very different than when you grow up, or sorry, when you wake up and you know exactly what you're going to do that day. Like today, I'm going to sit at my computer and I'm going to edit a teaser for a project. It's very predictable. Life on the road with Dan in Africa and the other adventures I've had, and I think for my dad in the middle of the ocean, is a very different experience of life that is extremely valuable and powerful and worth dying for.
Okay, so I had a very difficult patch of my life where I left behind a husband and followed my truth to be true to myself. And it was really painful and it was really hard on my family for a period of time. Your father was true to himself, and we admire that. He left behind two young kids. He left behind you and his wife and your brother, Adrian. Is it worth it being true to ourselves? What do you think?
It's an excellent question, and I asked my dad, my stepmom for 10 years, she basically for 10 years convinced him not to go. So he came up with the idea when he was 50, and he did it when he was 62. And he only in the last few years before he left, he said, okay, no, I have to do this, and he spent a few years preparing. For that 9 or 10 years that he wasn't going, I was really pushing for him to do it. I thought, well, why won't you? But I actually, as the years dragged on, I started, and he started to say he wanted to do it again. I heard Ellen, you know, and now the kids were older, right? Because they'd
Yeah.
started very young and now they're 12 and 15. And I said, well, why don't you wait until the kids are in college? You know, maybe that makes sense. Now I understand a bit of what Ellen's saying.
Yeah.
And he said, well, my body won't be able to do it. I'm 62. If I wait till I'm 72 or something or 70, that's asking for a catastrophe. And I may not even be able to depart. So I understood that too. Now that I have my own kids, and my daughter Viva has just turned 15, so she's exactly the same age that my oldest younger sister was. My oldest younger sister took it extremely hard. They both did. She had real challenges in her life after that. Whether they're directly related to my dad or related to other things or a combination, it's probably a combination, like we're all a combination of our experiences and who we are. Having seen that, that redoubles my determination to try and organize my own adventures and my own dreams that I have to pursue. Try and organize them in a way that are in harmony or as much as possible with my kids. So, for example, I've been refurbishing my dad's boat. So it was recovered. It had a tiny bit of damage to it, and it's been sitting in my driveway essentially for 20 years in other places.
Yeah.
And I just started refurbishing it because I'm working on a film inspired by the story. And
Is that what's behind you?
yes, exactly.
Yeah.
This is a rough draft of a poster that I put together just to give me a sense of what I'm working on. And the thought of putting that boat in the ocean is much more interesting to me now than it was when my dad did it. I mean, when my dad did it right before he left, I said, why don't you go with a friend? You know, to me, it would be like, I would do this with you. I would do it with a friend of mine. If Dan was here, you know, Chris or Jeff, I would do it with a
Yeah.
friend. And he essentially said, well, doing it alone means there's nobody else to screw it up. And I think that's part of his upbringing. You know, he said,
Yeah.
what brought him out there? I think his whole life was responding to so to the war, to poverty, to communism, to the experience, the opportunities he was given, and he didn't feel the freedom I did.
Yeah.
So, if I want to row across the ocean, for example, I will put it off until my kids are old enough that if tragedy happens, they will be hopefully more able to handle it. When my dad passed away, or when he disappeared, I thought, okay, he's fine. I promise you, he's fine. Like I was in North India when there was a huge earthquake. People were panicking back home and thought I had been killed because they hadn't heard from me. When I traveled around the world, there was no cell phone, so people didn't hear from me for a few weeks, and there was always some tragedy. I mean, if actually I landed in Kenya, the Rodney King riots were happening in LA as I landed in Kenya. So people who thought I was still in Los Angeles were worried that I was being killed by a mob in Los Angeles. People who knew I went to Kenya were worried about a war that broke out, literally bows and arrows, tribes fighting in Western Kenya at the day that we landed. I was always fine. So I knew my dad was fine. Okay, his satellite phone is wet. He'll call it, you know, he'll figure out, he'll flag down a ship. But when I realized he was gone, I didn't even feel the emotion. And I remember thinking of Dan, and I said, wow, when I knew Dan was gone, I was devastated. I did not understand how the world could keep going. Literally, the next day we had to go paint a house, you know, Jeff and I. And I thought, fuck, how am I going to pick up a, who cares about the paint on the damn house? Who cares about the house or the whole city or anything? But when my dad passed away, when they found his boat and I realized, okay, this is it, he's gone, I didn't even feel the emotion. I was 30 somehow, maybe because the experience with Dan. I had come to terms with loss in a way. I don't know what it was, but my sisters didn't take it that way. And I think it's because of my age. And so I will try and not do something exceedingly risky until they're a bit older. But that's the only thing. And like I said, if I was stuck in my dad's position where it's either do it now or not at all because you'll be too old, I might have to make the tough decision because ultimately, as adults, we do understand, I think. You know, I
You
think
know,
my
yeah.
sisters understand my dad's journey.
Yeah.
My
Right.
stepmom, who was very, I don't want to say we were combative, but she made it very clear. Your dad's a selfish jerk. You shouldn't do this. This is insane. This is not how normal people are. What is wrong with you? Right? She made that very clear. And so my defense mechanisms came up and said, hold on, hold on. He needs to do so. This is an adventure. This is like living life fully. I understand both sides now. And my stepmom in that time has become such a sweet, loving, wonderful, accepting person that when I apologized to her, she didn't need an apology. She just completely understood. I was 20 at the time, or I was 30 at the time. She said, how could you have understood?
That's why I married her. But you know, your whole life, it feels to me, has been trying to understand the meaning of life and following your truth and discovering, telling stories. And that's what I would urge you. A very risky prospect is trying to do a feature film or a documentary. Maybe you don't have to sail across the Atlantic. But your first film that achieved great note was Genghis Blues, about somebody who was following his truth, blind guy, and you can mention that. And then you went on to do a film called Happy, which really explores what makes us happy. And in our remaining 18 minutes, or whatever it is, I can't do math, you tell us about the essence of happiness that you've discovered. What makes us happy? What can people out there listening who are unhappy and dissatisfied, tell me.
Excellent. Thank you, Kathy. And I'm going to augment that with a tiny thing, which is when you follow your truth, we understand, people understand that intuitively. The rowing across the ocean is roughly as dangerous as riding a motorcycle. Now, if there's a loved one and we say, hey, they want to get a motorcycle, we might encourage them not to, but it's not like insanely risky. And in fact, many more people die from eating too many French fries and not exercising, you know, having unfortunate genes where you get a disease. I had a pain in my leg a couple years ago, and I found out it was a tumor in my spine. I mean, that's, according to the doctor, that was nothing that I could have had an impact on. Fortunately, it was removed, it was benign, everything's okay. But the point is, we really don't know when it's coming. So when something sounds extra risky, like going to Africa and leading a group of kids through East Africa when you're a 19-year-old kid, or rowing across the ocean, these things are very easy to assail, to say, oh, what a crazy thing. Why would you ever let somebody do that? But statistically, most of these things are not much more risky than a lot of things we do on a daily basis without recognizing it. Driving down the freeway and answering a cell phone call, for example, you know, it's equivalent to being drunk. And we think drunk driving is crazy. We don't think answering our cell phone is. So all that to say, happiness relates to death in that sense. What is it worth? What is going to fulfill us before that end? So far, all of us get there. And the solutions, fortunately, are very accessible. So one of the first things, you've heard it a million times, but it's gratitude. It's about appreciating what you do have. So there's a guy named Tim Kasser who studied this a lot, and he said, look, when you switch from complaining about the things you wish you had, I wish I was better looking, I wish I was younger, I wish I didn't have a tumor in my spine, I wish, you know, my dad was still alive, whatever you have to complain about that are very real complaints, those are worthy, those are fine. But if you switch from spending time focusing on those, just thinking about, oh, wow, what can I offer the world? Oh, I speak English decently well. I've had a good education. I have some experiences to share. You know, I know about filmmaking. I can help people with that if they want to learn about it. When you shift from what don't I have to what do I have that I can offer, that already boosts your happiness. Expressing your gratitude in very simple ways, leaving somebody a message, calling them, writing them a letter, they've discovered can increase your happiness for days and even weeks after you've made the gesture. So if I write Kathy, oh, dear Kathy, my second mom, you made my life what it is. If I do that, they can look at my brain in a brain scanner and 2 weeks from now see that there was a boost from that act. So even though we've heard this, we know that gratitude and appreciation is important. Science has helped us understand how we can manifest that in a way that's actually impactful in our happiness. Make the phone call. Write the letter. Even if you don't send the damn letter, it will boost your happiness because it put you in that mind state of gratitude. Novelty is another one. So some people need a lot of novelty. They need to go to Africa and take pictures in Somalia or ride bikes across Tanzania or row across the ocean. Other people, they just need to try a different place for lunch. They need to take a different route to work. novelty is, there's a huge spectrum of what works for us, but whatever your flavor of novelty is that you enjoy, do that a little bit. Just concentrate. Hey, go see an opera instead of a movie, or a movie instead of, you know, go out to see a movie instead of sitting at home. Do something a little different. That helps shake it up. That's really low-hanging fruit, right? We can all do that. We can all ride our bike instead of walk or something like that. Relationships. I asked Ed Diener, he studied happiness longer than anybody in America. I said, what is the key to happiness, right? I wanted to know, just like you, what can I offer people? And he said, well, some people have a job that's really rewarding and that makes them happiness. But other people, they have kind of a crappy job and it's okay because that job enables them to play soccer on the weekends or be with their families or do the things that make them happy. So it's not really the job. And we know that if you're very poor, money helps a lot. If you have, you know, if you have 5,000 bucks a year, an extra 5,000 bucks helps a lot in your happiness. But once you have kind of basic needs, extra money doesn't really help. So it's not really the job. It's not the money unless you're really poor. For most of us, it's relationships. So every single person he ever studied who was happy had good relationships. Now, it doesn't mean there wasn't somebody that they hated. It doesn't mean they were the life of the party. They were, you know, outgoing and, you know, they have a million friends. It basically meant that they loved and they were loved, right? You need to literally have one person at least that you love, that you truly love and feel loved. We can do that, right? You can be a curmudgeonly old, you know, codger and you can still love somebody. And I'm pretty sure somebody loves everybody out there. Like, I'm pretty sure I read a poem by somebody put online recently, and it basically said the tragedy of life is that we don't realize how much we're loved. We don't realize all the people that love us. You know, the person you smiled at the grocery store who was having a crappy day, who felt it. You know, the kid from your fifth grade class who remembers that you were always nice to them. So, you know, gratitude, novelty, valuing your relationships. I guess this is where the science comes in. So if relationships are important, don't keep making excuses, right? When your friend calls you for the birthday party or to go out for drinks or whatever it is, don't keep prioritizing your job, which doesn't necessarily make you happy, or these other things. Prioritize those relationships. So it was actually because of making happy that I live where I live. I live in Los Angeles because of you and Amy and my friends Chris and Ryan and Nicole. Because I had a group of friends down here, I realized I would never see them if I don't make the move. It's very normal in our society to tell somebody you're going to move to another place to go to college or for a career, you know, or job opportunity. But if you say you're going to move to another city to go hang out with your friends, it kind of seems crazy. But in fact, the science says that is more likely to make you happy. So is that kind of what you're looking for? No,
I'm looking for what you want to share. You live in a place called Paradise Cove, as I recall. You chose a place called Paradise, and Paradise is complicated. It's not happy all the time. Would you allow your daughter to go, as I allowed Amy at the age of 15, to go on safari with all you kids? Tell me honestly, what would you tell your wife?
I think of you, Kathy. I feel like you're sort of half a generation older than me, even though I guess since your kids, you know, are my age, I guess we're a full generation. But I think of you as a peer and a wise elder, and I think of you parenting a lot. And I was very impressed, especially when I was younger, that you were able to have the courage to do things that I wish other parents did. And really what I mean is you believed in your kids. And a lot of parents didn't believe that their kids could do things, could handle themselves. Mm-hmm. And that belief is a combination of knowing your kids are amazing and having taken a leap of faith. You know, we don't know what happens out in the world. When Gail and I had kids at first, our aspiration was absolutely to put them in a backpack, keep traveling, you know, sleeping in tents and train stations. And the opposite happened. We have hunkered down so much. And the thought of Viva now going, again, she's 15 right now. She's Amy's age on that trip. Absolutely would be. I mean, I have no idea how I would ever come to say yes unless I really trusted the kids. Because Viva, rock solid. Amazing.
Yeah.
She, I have no concern about. But that kid in charge, that Dan at age 19,
exactly.
I would vet that kid. I would like hang out with that kid and I would have to vet him. And knowing Dan as I knew him, you couldn't put a better person in charge. Literally, he was the guy who could navigate any situation. He was the person who, you know, he was the expert at local cultures in East Africa and finding ways to make people smile and diffuse tense situations. And so knowing Dan, yes, but I think I would be, it would be a family argument among the parents.
Well, we'd have to put us back in time. I think that might be a little tricky to do that now, although you'd have GPS, you'd have everything. You know, you, to me, have led, I would say, a boundless life. You've never been bound by society or other people's expectations that I perceive of you. And you are always seeing possibilities, you know, and just like your dad and your incredible mother with a Worldwide Ventures or whatever it was of PBS. Is there something you'd like to share that you feel people could bring that boundlessness? You haven't left Paradise Cove a whole lot in the last 20 years or 30 years. You've had some adventures, but you've led a boundless life. What would you urge people or to consider doing to create more happiness? You've given us some guidance for sure. Anything more you want to add?
Okay, this is going to sound like a weird one. There's alcoholism in my family. It was very close to home. So I was kind of inoculated. There's no way I was going to drink. I saw how bad that could be, so I never drank. In about eighth grade, when a couple kids started drinking, and in high school when they were drinking, I noticed one benefit, which is there were some kids who were really uptight or really shy, and when they would drink, they would kind of loosen up. And I remember thinking, okay, I'm not going to drink, but I want that benefit. I want to not give a damn what anybody else thinks. I want to be able to dance like nobody's there. I want to be able to not care. And so that was a conscious idea that if I can do that and stay sober, because everybody who drank that I saw, they got dumber, angrier, yes, sometimes more open, but they were less attractive. You know, it's just like there were so many negatives. There was just no way I was going to do that. So if I could just pluck that one positive out, and I think that has stayed with me and has helped me pursue the things that I want to pursue and live the way that I have, because a lot of my decisions, you wouldn't advise somebody like that.
Yeah.
You know, I, for example, I don't run my business like a business. I was only realizing that now. I used to love business. When I was a kid, I used to buy and sell used bicycles. And then we started painting houses. I loved business. I just loved the creativity of it and the sense of achievement. I've been a filmmaker for 30 some years and I don't run it like a business. I just, if something grabs me, I just say, oh shit, I have to do this now. Let's figure out how to make it work. And friends, well-meaning friends who've known me my whole life, sometimes advise me in ways and I just can't take the advice because I think it relates to this idea that the things that move me, the things that make me feel free and excited and engaged are stronger than the rational logic that comes from our mainstream culture sometimes. And, you know, it doesn't always work. Like my pressure right now and for the last 25 years, on and off, every few years, I feel financial pressure. But I'll tell you, I don't feel like existential angst. I don't feel like I haven't fulfilled my dreams. I don't feel like if that tumor in my spine was malignant, there's no big project I've been putting off. It would be fucking horrible. But I would, in many ways, I think that these decisions that are irrational according to society's rules have made me very comfortable in ways that are important to me.
I
feel fulfilled.
To be, I was going to use that word, fulfilled. And being fulfilled is, you know, that's something to be truly grateful for. Most people, I believe, are either looking back at lives of quiet mediocrity. I don't know that that's so many people who are listening to this particular podcast, but still have yearnings, unsatisfied parts of themselves. And you, to me, with this boundless, beautiful spirit, are a person who I've always respected above almost anybody else in the world. You are exactly who you are. If I scratch you and try to find another Rocco inside, I'm not going to find that person. And you are the one person in the world that I know that if anything happened and I needed a hut in the back of your garden, in the back of your whatever, 2 foot or whatever, 2 bit wide, I know you would keep me and my goats back there. And for that, I am truly grateful, because Dan offered that to me and then he wasn't around. But I want all of us to find out more about Rocco Bellic, learn about the film that you're doing, support the film that you're doing, and watch the happy film, watch Genghis Blues, and know that there is so much more to life inside and out, and we can learn so much from you, my beloved, beloved Rocco. And thank you for taking this time.
I love you, Kathy.
Thank you. Boundlessly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dear Rocco, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your stories, and your enduring sense of wonder. What strikes me most about this conversation is that happiness isn't a destination we kind of arrive at. It's something we create through connection, purpose, curiosity, gratitude, very important, and service. Your work reminds me that the answers I'm seeking may not be found in having more, but in being more fully present to the life I'm already living. To everybody listening, I hope today's conversation, wonderful conversation, inspires you to look at your own life through a wider lens, to stay curious, and to remember that even in really difficult times, there's always the possibility of meaning, connection, and joy. So until next time, keep exploring, keep creating, and keep living boundlessly.